Richfield is on the air. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arthur Hale, confidentially yours. 15 minutes of news behind the news, gathered by Transradio and presented on behalf of the independent distributors and dealers in Richfield Gasoline and Richlube Motor Oil, those partners in power that keep your motor young. By the way, do you always have good luck when you go fishing? If not, you'll be interested in an announcement later on. Listen for it. Every surface indication tonight points to an almost immediate spread of the war to the Pacific. Confidential advices from the Orient, however, suggest that it will not be surprising if the Japanese suddenly discover that they don't need naval and air bases at the southern tip of French Indochina after all. Fast-moving developments during the past 24 hours have made radical changes in the aspect of the Far Eastern situation, and there has been a sudden lull in the truculent sword-rattling heard in Tokyo as late as yesterday. Today, the Konoye government found itself face-to-face with stern opposition from outside, and what was even more serious for its plans, confronted with an appalling lack of support at home. It must be remembered that to date, there has been no formal or official announcement that Japan was to occupy naval and air bases on southern Indochina. It was officially announced in Hanoi last night that certain demands concerning Indochina had been submitted to the Vichy government. In Vichy, a government spokesman said the French government had agreed in principle to the Japanese demands. Sensational reports were circulated of the appearance of a formidable Japanese naval force convoying a fleet of army transports off the Indochina coast. However, it must be remembered that these reports originated in Chinese sources. The Chinese have very good reasons for creating the impression of a serious Japanese threat to British and United States interests. But up until this hour, there are no reports from any source of the landing or the preparation for landing of Japanese troops at Saigon or Kamran Bay. A sudden muting of the Tokyo war drums was noticeable this morning about the time that the Japanese government had finished decoding a cable from its envoy in Washington, Admiral Nomura, reporting on his Wednesday interview with Undersecretary of State Wells. Undersecretary Wells told Admiral Nomura that the United States government would consider Japanese occupation of bases in southern Indochina as a threat to the Philippines and to vital United States supply routes. That was realistic language with a vengeance, rather than the usual, more restrained talk of a policy of not recognizing territory acquired by force or a threat of force. By informing the Japanese that the United States considered a threat to exist, Undersecretary Wells made it unmistakably clear that the Washington government could be expected to do something about it. Meanwhile, in Tokyo, the inspired press opened a feverish campaign to assure the Japanese people that if the United States took economic measures in retaliation for Japan's occupation of Indochina, the measures would prove a boomerang. The newspapers pictured widespread unemployment in the United States if imports of Japanese raw silk were placed under embargo. Naturally, the Tokyo newspapers said nothing concerning the effects on Japan's raw silk industry if its biggest and almost only remaining market should be closed. The Japanese newspapers also renewed their charges that the United States and Britain were conspiring with China and the Soviet Union to encircle Japan. The press campaign, obviously, was aimed at winning reluctant public support for the government's new aggressive policies. Late reports from neutral observers indicate that the winning of such support is a well-nigh impossible task, and that any move that carries with it a threat of a clash with the United States will be opposed by a large section of the Japanese public. Therefore, these observers reason, Japan may not go through with her program. It was recognized, however, that there was a strong probability that the Konoye regime has been pushed too far by the radical military element in Japan to turn back, and must see the thing through or lose face, both at home and abroad. In addition to the expansionist clique at home, the Tokyo government is under terrific pressure from Berlin to implement its pledges under the Three Power Pact. With his armies slowing up on the Russian front and the British Air Force pounding at his war industries, Hitler is in desperate need of a diversion to lessen British and American pressure, and the Far East is the logical place for it. The decision is up to Japan, and it's still 50-50 tonight on whether the Nipponese will take the gamble of obeying the orders from Berlin and risking war with the democracies, or back down and abandon the long-held dream of a completely Japanese-dominated Orient. As you've probably heard time and again, carrying coals to Newcastle is a very futile job. But carrying coal to Lewiston, Pennsylvania, is something else again, as Homer C. Truscott could easily prove to you. Homer C. Truscott is a coal dealer and carries coal to Lewiston and vicinity direct from the mines. Now, to carry the coal, he has a fleet of 7 trucks, and to power his 7 trucks, he must have gasoline. That's elementary. But picking the right gasoline to power his trucks is far from elementary. It's a job that calls for testing one gasoline against another and selecting from many brands the one brand that gives the most miles for the least cost. In other words, you've got to find the gasoline that will pay you a profit. Homer C. Truscott has picked Richfield high-octane gasoline as the gasoline that pays him a profit in long mileage and surging power. For his money, Richfield High Octane is the champion of all regular-priced gasolines. Now, when gasoline-buying experts like Homer Truscott choose Richfield High Octane gasoline over every other brand, there must be something to it. So wouldn't it be a good idea to try this famous Richfield High Octane in your car? Try it, Thankful. The next time you need gasoline, ride with a champion and keep your motor young. The murders of 2 young girls in nearby towns in Massachusetts last week promised strong repercussions in several state legislatures next year, not only in the East, but also in the South and the West. Some of the welfare and law enforcement associations keep a very close finger on the pulse of opinion in many states, and they report that the Massachusetts murders may well become a cause célèbre in the annals of American penology and court procedure. The aspect of the cases that is causing the most attention is the fact that a 16-year-old high school boy held in one of the murders had a record of 2 previous arrests for attempted criminal assault. In the first case, the boy received a suspended sentence. In the second, he was at liberty under bail. Now, deplorable as the circumstances seem, the case looks on the surface like a strictly local matter, a case in which people of other states can have nothing but academic interest. But quite another story is told about this aspect in New York. It's declared that the case will be the springboard for a nationwide movement to put a stop to what realists call wishful experimentation in penology and granting paroles. The realists and conservatives will make their hardest fight for laws to prevent continuation of parole, bail, or suspended sentences after the offender is accused the second time. They claim that parole officers, judges, and social workers connected with the courts continually grant freedom to a youth who is entangled a second time with the law after being paroled once. This is done, according to the critical lawyers and police officials, both because of false humanitarianism and because of the stubborn refusal of those involved to admit that they have made a mistake. Just plain stubborn professional pride. The whole parole system has been under attack for several years now in a number of legislatures because of this so-called do-gooder attitude, and the Massachusetts cases apparently are just what the opponents of leniency toward young offenders have been looking for in the way of ammunition. Now that Dr. Chaim Weizmann has returned to England by plane, it can be revealed that he's perfecting a new high explosive to help Britain win the war against Hitler. Dr. Weizmann is best known to the world for his activities in behalf of the Zionist cause. He's president of the Jewish Agency for Palestine and the World Zionist Organization. However, Dr. Weizmann is equally famous in the world of science as a biochemist. During the World War, Dr. Weizmann was an obscure chemistry professor at the University of Manchester. Germany's submarine blockade had cut off England's access to acetone, necessary to the manufacture of TNT. Prime Minister Lloyd George called in Dr. Weizmann and put him in charge of the Chemical Warfare Department. He was told that he had only a limited amount of time in which to discover a new source of supply of acetone. He set to work, and far sooner than anyone had expected, he discovered a new source of which there was an abundant supply in England. He succeeded in extracting acetone from, of all things, chestnuts. For this achievement, the British government was prepared to pay Dr. Weizmann homage and shower him with honors. The great Jewish scientist declined all honors with the statement that he wished for only one thing, that the British government aid the Jews in establishing a Jewish national home in Palestine. Today, Britain is going through another critical period, and Dr. Weizmann is busy again. Confidentially, we can tell you that since the outbreak of the war, he's been directing chemical research in his laboratories in England, as well as in his Chemical Research Institute in Palestine. Among other things, Dr. Weizmann has discovered a process for extracting acetone from oranges, the main crop in Palestine. One of the reasons for Dr. Weizmann's visit to America was to study the chemical side of the defense industry in this country. The last 5 weeks of his visit were spent in California, center of America's orange production. Tonight, Dr. Wiseman is back in England, ready to communicate the results of his work to the British government. And soon, we are told, Britain will have a new explosive which will far exceed in power anything previously seen on the face of the earth. Before signing off, we'll have an inside story about legislation to permit draftees to be sent outside the Western Hemisphere. Meanwhile, once upon a time, fishermen had to throw in a line to find out if the fish were biting. But those trial and error days are gone forever. The Richfield Fisherman's Calendar, you see, tells you how the fish will bite on any given day throughout the year. Its predictions are based on the moon, the tides, and other factors which influence fishing. Now, the calendar is absolutely free. Just ask for one at your Richfield dealers. And ask your Richfield dealer, too, for a Richfield Fisherman's Roadmap of the state in which you're planning a fishing trip. This map will show you popular fishing spots, tell you catch limits, and other fishing laws. Now, here's a suggestion for every motorist. To conserve gasoline for national defense, keep your spark plugs clean and properly spaced. Just one dirty or faulty plug may waste 1 gallon of gasoline in 10. Now, there'll be other gasoline-saving suggestions on future Confidentially Yours programs. Try them to make every gallon of gasoline do extra duty. And try the gasoline selected for extra duty by thousands of transportation experts. Richfield high-octane gasoline. Ride with a champion and keep your motor young. When Acting Secretary of State Sumner Wells cracked down verbally on Japan today, a number of military and naval men in Washington nodded their heads knowingly. They made it clear, albeit confidentially, that if President Roosevelt and the State Department want a showdown with Japan, the president has the power to achieve it without waiting for congressional action. Although the President and Chief of Staff General Marshall, for the sake of unity, are trying to win the consent of Congress to remove its ban on the use of drafted soldiers abroad, actually, they say, the President has the power to send any part of the Army, Navy, or Marine Corps, including the draftees and the National Guard, anywhere he thinks necessary, even in the face of a direct prohibition of such action by Congress. These officers contend that Congress exceeded its constitutional authority by writing into the draft law a ban on service outside the Western Hemisphere. They contend that the Constitution gives the President the clear power to send any part of the armed forces anywhere in the world, and that the only real control Congress has is over the purse strings of the military establishment. No mere law can amend the Constitution. In other words, while the President probably wishes to act by and with the consent of Congress, they say he doesn't have to have that consent. He can send warships, marines, and even units of the Army containing drafted men and National Guardsmen to the farthest reaches of the Pacific. Congress would then be faced with the choice of either supporting the President or refusing to appropriate money for American armed forces that were already in the field. Congress could also move to impeach the President, but this particular group of military men insist the impeachment would fail, for they are sure that the constitutional legality is on the side of the President. And that's Confidentially Yours, Arthur Hale. The material for Confidentially Yours is gathered and prepared by Transradio. The next program will be tomorrow night at 7:15. Keep them flying.
This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.